It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. The U.S. military said Sunday it was evaluating whether an airstrike in Libya killed an al-Qaeda-linked militant leader, Mokhtar Belmokhtar. U.S. State Department had posted a $5 million reward for Belmokhtar, who they accuse of leading a 2013 terrorist attack on a gas facility in Algeria that killed 37 people, including 3 Americans. Yemen's warring factions are on their way to Geneva for the first significant talks in the months-long conflict. Talks today, facilitated by the United Nations, will bring to the table Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels and the exiled government of President Abu Rabu Mansour Hadi. Former U.S. Ambassador to Turkey and Iraq, James Jeffrey, spoke with VOA about the possibility of success in the Geneva talks.
There is pressure for a solution because, first of all, there is a tremendous humanitarian crisis involving many millions of people in that population, which is somewhere over 20 million, involving both long-standing drought conditions and the disruption caused by the fighting and the bombing.
The Houthis took control of Yemen's government in February, leading Mr. Hadi to flee to Saudi Arabia. Since then, Saudi-led airstrikes against the rebels and their allies have continued in several Yemeni provinces. At least 11 suspected Somali-based Al-Shabaab militants were killed in dawn attacks on Sunday on a Kenyan military base in Lamu County. 2 soldiers also killed. The latest attack came as the country prepared to mark the one-year anniversary of 2 attacks in the town of Impekatone in Lamu County, in which militants killed more than 60. This is VOA News. A South African court is expected to rule today on whether Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir in South Africa to attend an African Union summit should be handed over to the International Criminal Court to face charges of crimes against humanity. Sunday, a South African judge prevented him from leaving the country. In Khartoum, Sudanese Foreign Ministry official Kamal Ismail said the court ruling has no legal value and his government was assured by South Africa prior to the visit that Mr. Bashir would be welcome and was expected to return to Sudan on schedule. Foreign Affairs Minister Ibrahim Al-Gandour echoed the view in Johannesburg.
President Bashir is participating in this summit on an invitation from the AU and a welcoming reception from the government of South Africa. And as you know, that the summit, the African Union summit, has always been against ICC and its indictment to African presidents, including President Bashir. President Bashir is here to participate in the summit. He will stay until the end of the summit and leave on the scheduled time.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party said it was calling upon the government to challenge the order against Mr. Bashir, citing immunity, that is, that was granted to all participants of the AU summit. ICC has charged Mr. Bashir with war crimes and genocide for sending the army and backing Arab militia to put down armed uprising and Darfur conflict in 2003 that left 300,000 dead and 2 million refugees. Most of the victims were civilians. British media report that London has had to pull its spies from so-called hostile countries after Russia and China learned how they operate by decrypting top-secret files disclosed 2 years ago by former U.S. national security contractor Edward Snowden. Mark Field is a member of the Intelligence and Security Committee in the British Parliament.
There's a lot of unintended collateral damage that was done. And a lot of spying, a lot of intelligence is like an enormous jigsaw. You only have a few pieces of it, but you don't know what the other side have got in terms of their pieces of the jigsaw.
An official at Prime Minister David Cameron's office says there is no evidence of anyone being harmed. In U.S. politics, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, the son and brother of U.S. presidents, set to officially announce his candidacy for president today, becoming the 11th Republican in the race. Meanwhile, the leading Democratic Party presidential contender, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is campaigning in Iowa. Get more news at our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human rights groups go to court today to argue why the South African government should stop Sudan's President Bashir from leaving the country.
The South African government is required to abide by all South African court decisions, part of their constitutional obligation, and we do believe that they would do that.
Carolyn James is a lawyer with the Southern Africa Litigation Center. Meanwhile, Sudan's government says it is confident the South African government will not arrest President Bashir. We'll also get expert analysis on the impact the drama is having on the African Union summit. And Kenya sees a rise in shisha pilots.
I like the head rush the product gives. Also, the wide variety of flavors I can actually change depending on how I feel.
That's Lan Chiwaini of Nairobi. Egypt says it's on track to open a new Suez Canal in August. And an American cardiologist fixes broken hearts in Uganda. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Lawyers for the South African government and the Southern Africa Litigation Center are due in court this morning to argue whether the South African government has an obligation to prevent Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir from leaving the country where he is attending the African Union summit. A South African judge Sunday ordered the South African government to stop Mr. Bashir from leaving the country after the International Criminal Court called for him to be arrested. The Sudanese president has been charged with war crimes and genocide stemming from his military's role in the Darfur conflict. Carolyn James is a lawyer with the Southern Africa Litigation Center. She said the South African government has a constitutional obligation to abide by all court decisions, including stopping President Bashir from leaving the country.
Our objective is just to clarify the obligations that South Africa does have in respect to fugitives from the ICC who may be present in the country. And it's to determine whether, irrespective of any AU resolutions or diplomatic immunity supposedly connected to participation in an African Union summit, to determine whether the obligations under international as well as South African law still apply and that South African authorities are obliged to arrest him.
And what do you think? Do you think the South African courts or the authorities will act on whatever the courts say? Because as you mentioned, I think there is an African Union resolution which allows every country where the African Union is having its summit to give immunity to all the presidents who are coming. Are you aware of that?
Yes, that information will all be placed before the court. I think that we have full faith in the court system to issue the correct decision. If they do find that the South African authorities are not obliged to arrest President Bashir, we will, of course, accept that decision. But we do also expect that if the court is to rule that there is an obligation to arrest him, the South African authorities would then also respect that court decision and take action to then effect the court order and arrest him if that is what the court does rule.
Do you believe in the ICC? Because there's a lot of criticism of the ICC. Some people, in fact, some African leaders have said this ICC targets just African leaders.
Sure. I mean, I think that there may be merit in that discussion, and it is a fact that all the ongoing investigations of the ICC are against African countries. But it's very important to note that the majority of those situations have been referred to the ICC by African countries themselves. And so they have requested the International Court to investigate the crimes that have been committed on their territories. So it isn't completely imposed from outside. And so African countries had initially indicated that they were willing to be bound and were enthusiastic of the court. And the other thing that is important to note is that although you can argue that the ICC is targeting African leaders, you can also argue that it is taking special efforts to ensure that African victims of human rights violations are given access to justice. Because all the situations in Africa that the ICC is investigating involve crimes committed against African citizens.
So, Ms. James, what should we expect today, Monday? What's going to happen?
What we expect this morning is that the court hearing will proceed again at 11:30. Both sides of the application will make arguments. Our legal representative will argue on why we believe that President Bashir should be arrested and why there are obligations on the South African government to do so. And the South African government will argue and explain their arguments that there is not that similar obligation. And then we do expect the court to adjourn before the judge issues the ruling, sometime either later today or possibly even tomorrow.
Caroline James is a lawyer with the Southern Africa Litigation Center. She was speaking with me from Johannesburg. Sudan says it is not worried about the well-being of President Omar al-Bashir in South Africa. This after a South African judge Sunday ordered the South African government to prevent Mr. Bashir from leaving the country after the International Criminal Court called for him to be arrested. Information Minister Ahmed Bilao said President Jacob Zuma of South Africa has assured Mr. Bashir that he is an honorable guest of the South African government and that nothing will happen to him. Bilao described the ICC as a tool created by the West specifically to punish only Africans while ignoring human rights violations elsewhere.
Actually, nothing had happened. Our president went to South Africa to attend the African summit on invitation from President Jacob Zuma with a guarantee that nothing would happen. And in fact, we went there, we heard that there is some court in Africa or South Africa or something like that, but nothing had happened. And actually, a reassurance from the president himself, from the authorities from South Africa, the Minister of Foreign Affairs actually this morning came to the president and told him that nothing will happen. You are a guest, an honorable guest. You can stay anytime you like in South Africa. Nothing will happen. You go back to your country, safe and these things. And that's why the president attended the meetings, the opening session, the closed session, the open session, and tomorrow he will attend the final session as he come back home.
Does your government feel angry the fact that this has happened, that a court in South Africa has banned your president not to leave?
No, actually, we know that any court can do this, but the authorities who can make the decision can arrest the president. And we have very good relations with the government of South Africa. We know that they are not going to arrest the president, and nothing happens, and are not under action.
There are those who say, but if you say that African leaders should not pay attention to the ICC, then you are allowing impunity, meaning anybody who commits crime should be left free.
Actually, you know, this allegation, and this is actually the ICC, we read the ICC that it is a court practically directed toward punishment of the African leaders. And a lot of crimes have been now committed around the world. And these countries have gotten an immunity from asking them in Israel, in the United States, everywhere. But why would only this be applied to the Africans? Our president is not a criminal. This is allegations. You know that is not true. And you know what they have done with Uhuru, the president of Kenya. It was just some sort of an act. And he went there and he gets free and so forth. I think this is actually a stick for punishment of the African leaders, not more. Actually, we are also supporting an intention towards establishing an African court. And this will be a court of justice.
So, Mr. Minister, your country is certain that President Bashir, at the end of the African Union Summit, will return to Sudan. Are you certain?
Absolutely. He's an honorable guest there. President Zuma has said this, afternoon, that President Bashir is an honorable guest. He can attend South Africa anytime he likes, and he go back safely to his country anytime he wants.
Ahmed Bilao is Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from Khartoum. This week's African Union summit has been interrupted by the drama over what to do with Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, whose arrival at the Johannesburg summit could compel South Africa to arrest him on an international war crimes warrant. The U.S. State Department says Washington strongly supports the international efforts to hold accountable those responsible for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from the summit sidelines in Johannesburg.
Sudan's president looked relaxed and confident as he lined up with other African heads of state for a group picture at the AU summit. But around him, a firestorm is brewing. President Omar al-Bashir is the target of an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court. He has been indicted for crimes against humanity and genocide in the Western Darfur region of Sudan. South Africa is a member state of the International Court, and so, legal experts argue, the nation is obliged to arrest him. Institute of Security Studies Managing Director Anton du Plessis says he agrees with the prominent South African and international groups that have demanded Mr. Bashir's arrest.
The South African government is arguing that the immunity provisions or agreements that it has with the AU means that it does not need to comply with its obligations under the Rome Statute and the Security Council to arrest him. Our view on that is that it's incorrect and that, in fact, the obligations are very much still in place and that South Africa does have an obligation to arrest and hand President Bashir over. That is also the opinion of the International Criminal Court, which last night the pretrial chamber issued a very clear order which clarified this position.
But there were no manacles on the president as he lined up and chatted with South African President Jacob Zuma and Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Instead, Mr. Bashir stood in the front row of the group photo, smiled, and flashed a thumbs-up sign. Mr. Bashir's situation is far from stable. On Sunday, a South African court issued an urgent interdiction to bar him from leaving South Africa until the court hears the appeal calling for his arrest. But it is not clear how that will be enforced. The Sudanese president reportedly entered, like many other African heads of state here for the summit, on an official plane that landed at a South African Air Force base in the capital, Pretoria. South Africa's president previously said in 2009 that he will call for Mr. Bashir's arrest if he enters South Africa. Du Plessis says this affair reflects badly on South Africa.
What it does say about South Africa is that our, even though our government has taken a particular position on this, we still have a very robust civil society, we still have a very independent judiciary. And I hope that by the end of this, the message will be clear that you can't be alleged of committing these crimes and just come to South Africa and no one says anything.
The African Union has previously argued the court is biased against African nations. Author David Hoyle says he agrees with this position.
What the AU should do, certainly en masse or bilaterally, is actually leave the ICC. It's a dysfunctional court. It's not working properly. And I think it's irretrievably flawed. With regards to what South Africa should do, again, I think it's actually pretty clear. In terms of the UN Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Immunity, any sitting head of state has sovereign immunity.
Mr. Bashir appears to be in that situation within the plush halls of the AU summit. But what happens once he leaves these doors is anyone's guess. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 15th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Egyptian authorities say they are on track to open a new Suez Canal on August 6, a project they say will more than double the canal's income during the next 10 years. But as viewers Heather Murdoch reports from Ismailia, Egypt, some analysts say the project alone will not be enough to rescue the country's failing economy.
Authorities say Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi plans to announce the new Suez Canal is open for business on August 6th. At that time, they say ships around the world will blast their horns in recognition of the event. Suez Canal Authority head Admiral Mohab Mohammed Hussein Mamish says the project will cut the amount of time it takes to travel through the canal in half, lowering costs for shippers. The Suez Canal is a major shipping route connecting Europe and Asia and brought in $5.5 billion last year. The new canal is an expansion of the current canal that will allow ships to pass by each other like a two-lane highway as opposed to a single lane. Less than 10 years from now, says Mamish, the expanded canal will earn $13 billion a year for Egypt. But naval history professor Andrew Lambert of King's College in London says the canal's success will depend largely on the global shipping industry, which Egypt cannot control. Even if it is successful, he adds, he does not think it will be enough to improve the lives of average Egyptians who are suffering rising poverty and prices as the economy tries to recover from the financial and political turmoil between 2011 and 2013.
That's a high-risk strategy. And Egypt is a large, complex country with a very big population. It's highly unlikely it's going to be able to live off the kinds of incomes it will get even from two canals. The costs of governing Egypt are very large. There's major debt problems.
But authorities say the economy is growing and the canal is one of many projects intended to boost foreign investment and generate income. From a boat meandering by construction sites on the new canal Sunday, giant waterspouts are seen slowly raising the level of the waterway. The boat is provided by the Suez Canal Authority to promote the project. Reporters snap pictures while workers drop hints about who may be attending the opening bash. Kings and presidents, for certain, along with hundreds of celebrities. The project was scheduled to take a year, but a year ago, analysts balked at the possibility that it could be finished so fast. And while no ship horns are blowing yet, Egyptian officials are confident that they will be blowing soon. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Ismailia, Egypt.
Thousands of children in developing nations like Uganda are born with heart problems, and thousands more contract heart diseases in their youth. An American cardiologist has taken it upon himself to see that Ugandan children get the treatment they need. VOA's Mike Richmond has more on this doctor with a huge heart.
It's been a busy day for pediatric cardiologist Craig Sable at the Uganda Heart Institute at Mulago National Referral Hospital in the capital, Kampala. He has examined a number of children with serious heart ailments and overseen medical procedures on them, like 4-year-old Victoria here.
She'll hopefully outlive us all. Take really good care of her and make sure she recovers okay.
This experience is nothing new for Sable, who has been leading medical missions here for more than a decade.
In Uganda,
many Ugandan children are born with health defects such as holes in their heart, while others are stricken with rheumatic heart diseases in their youth. Sable selects patients for operations and serves as a consultant to American and Ugandan surgeons before, during, and after procedures. He has overseen about 500 open-heart surgeries on Ugandan children with a 95% survival rate, which, as he put it, is almost as good as it gets in the United States.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Okay?
I think it's probably a good idea.
So we put the needle in here, draw out. When you get fluid, you undo your needle, take this wire, you put the wire in, like you're in the cath lab, okay?
I think the most striking thing to me is when I walk into the waiting room and see 50 to 100 children who I know if they were here, they would get fixed, and I know that we have a chance to help them.
Ugandan cardiologist Twalib Aliku has learned a lot from his American counterpart.
Basically, he started the program when we couldn't do any surgeries on our own, and we've reached this point where we are doing many surgeries on our own as a country. So, I mean, it's just tremendous what he's done.
Sable says he will continue his efforts to modernize Uganda's pediatric cardiology system.
My hope is they can transition from being a fledgling program that does a few heart surgeries to become a model for the region and other parts of the developing world.
Mike Richmond, VOA News, Washington.
In Kenya, the smoking of shisha, a type of flavored tobacco, is the latest craze. Patrons are flogging to shisha parlors to smoke and socialize. But the practice can be addictive and harmful, though many dabblers may not realize the dangers, according to a new review. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
26-year-old Ian Chiwaine has skillfully mastered the art of setting up his shisha pipe. Chiwaine, who runs an events management company, is an enthusiast of shisha. For the past 4 years, he has been using shisha as a recreational drag. A shisha kit, such as this one, costs around $10, and the various flavors range between $5 to $10. Chiwaine says he quit smoking conventional cigarettes and turned to shisha due to its recreational nature.
I like the head rush the product gives. Also, the wide variety of flavors, I can actually change depending on how I feel and depending on also what my friends feel, because I can't go to the club and smoke it alone or even in the house. It's more of a recreational drug.
Shisha smoking involves a glass-bottomed water pipe, a hookah, in which flavored tobacco is covered with a paper foil and roasted using coal. Before it's inhaled, the tobacco passes through a water port. Shisha smoking has gradually become popular in Kenya among young people, especially in the capital. Most bars set up lounges for shisha smokers. Smoking at home is on the rise too. But there are dangers. Last year, Kenya's Ministry of Health banned 19 flavors found to have been laced with heroin and marijuana. According to the World Health Organization, one hookah session typically lasts 20 to 80 minutes, and a hookah user may inhale as much smoke during one session as a cigarette smoker would from 100 or more cigarettes. Kenya regulates tobacco through a 2007 law. Public places for tobacco use have been set up in the capital, and all tobacco-related products carry a health message warning of its adverse effects. Still, about 2.5 million Kenyan adults use tobacco, according to the 2014 Global Adult Tobacco Survey.
That was reporter Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi. And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Mamadou Thiam's 77th-minute strike propelled tournament debutant Senegal to a 1-0 triumph over Uzbekistan in the quarterfinals at men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Wellington, New Zealand on Sunday. Earlier on, Mali required a 4-3 post-match penalty shootout advantage to get past Germany in Christchurch. The two sides tied 1-1 at the end of 120 minutes of open play. In Canada, African champions Nigeria Super Falcons lost to Australia 2-0 in Winnipeg, as defending champions Japan edged Cameroon 2-1 in Vancouver at the FIFA Women's World Cup on Friday, while Thailand edged Ivory Coast 3-2 in Ottawa. Today, Monday, Ivory Coast play Norway in Moncton. Meanwhile, Ghana overpowered Mauritius 7-1 in 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers in Accra on Sunday. Cameroon edged Mauritania 1-0. Togo beat Liberia 2-1. Egypt dismissed Tanzania 3-0. Republic of Congo and Kenya drew 1-1, as did Equatorial Guinea and Benin. Rwanda pipped Mozambique 1-0. The Democratic Republic of Congo beat Madagascar 2-1. Sudan edged Sierra Leone 1-0. Ethiopia outplayed Lesotho 2-1. And Niger beat Namibia 1-0. Early on Saturday, Cape Verde Islands thrashed Sao Tome and Principe 7-1. Uganda beat Botswana 2-0. Zimbabwe pipped Malawi 2-1. Nigeria outplayed Chad 2-0. South Africa and Gambia drew 0-0, as did Zambia and Guinea-Bissau. Senegal dismissed Burundi 3-1. Algeria trounced Seychelles 4-0. Mali beat South Sudan 2-0. Angola mauled the Central African Republic 4-0 as Burkina Faso beat Comoro Islands 2-0. On Friday, Swaziland edged Guinea 2-1. Tunisia crushed Djibouti 8-1 as Morocco pipped Libya 1-0. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Olympic and world 800-meter record holder David Rudisha bounced back in style, winning the two-lap race in 1 minute and 43.58 seconds at the IWF Diamond League in New York City in the United States of America on Saturday. His time is the second fastest in the world this year. Defending champion Wade Van Niekerk bettered his South Africa 400-meter record to 44.24 seconds. Ethiopian Hiwota Eleo triumphed in women's 3,000-meter steeplechase in 9 minutes and 24. 5.26 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. A South African judge has ordered authorities to prevent Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir from leaving the country after the International Criminal Court called for him to be arrested at an African Union summit in South Africa. That's it for this Monday, June 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Botti, Washington, saying, I hope you make this week a very productive one.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. And on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.